This podcast is a part of CGN Media, a podcast network that points to Christ. We are supported by listeners like you. To help us create more great shows, visit cgnmedia.org/support.
The conversation that you are about to hear was recorded in May of 2018 on the eve of the Irish abortion referendum. My name is Mike Neglia, and I spoke with two intelligent and well-spoken members of the church that I'm the pastor of, Calvary Cork in the Republic of Ireland. And I asked a few questions and then sat back and listened as they spoke about a holistic pro-life ethic that extends dignity to those who are living with disabilities and honors the image of God that's present in every woman and man, boy and girl, and every single baby, whether born or developing in utero. The situation in Ireland, which has been my home for the past 18 years, is different than the current situation in the USA. So the Irish Constitution included an amendment, the Eighth Amendment, which guaranteed a right to life to unborn babies. It was added in 1983 after a national referendum, and then ultimately it was removed by a national referendum, which took place at the end of May 2018. One of the main talking points of the pro-choice campaigners was the disability issue. And so this conversation frequently comes back to what scripture and the church and a Christian ethic has to say to those who are living with disabilities. This recording was one of the ways that our church was seeking to be salt and light in this issue. I present it to you as somewhat of a cultural artifact from Ireland that it might be of use to those of you who are currently living in the USA on the cusp of a revived conversation around the right to life and dignity of the unborn. But you know, wherever you live, Ireland, the USA, the rest of the world, hopefully this is a useful resource to you and it will stir your hearts and affections towards the sort of things that are important to our God. So I hope this helps. And then also, thanks so much to Mary and Abigail, who have given their permission for this to be rebroadcast to a wider audience. All right, let's go back to May of 2018. Hi, and welcome to the Vox Hibernia podcast. On this episode, I sit down with Mary and Abigail, two well-spoken and well-educated ladies, and we talk about disability, value, and the Eighth Amendment. So I think it was a very careful and thoughtful conversation, and I really hope you enjoy listening along. Welcome to the Vox Hibernia podcast. At the time of recording, it's a beautiful Saturday morning. It is the second warm day in a row, and I'm here with Mary and Abigail, and we are inside a room with barely any windows because, yeah, we're going to be talking about the Eighth Amendment. So it's so sunny and warm outside. The posters are just glistening in the sun, aren't they? And here we are inside. So Abigail, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm Abigail. I am a woman in my early to mid-20s. And I suppose my background is I have worked as a healthcare professional. I have a degree in something healthcare related, and I'm currently doing a master's in something law related. And I'm being deliberately and slightly obtusely vague because I'm just emphasizing the fact that I'm speaking in my own capacity today. And yeah.
Yeah, as we were saying earlier, you probably shouldn't take law or legal advice from a podcast.
Yeah, none of this is medical or legal advice. This is my own understanding of this. And I suppose primarily I am talking today as someone who I would identify as an overthinker. And I have thought a lot about this topic and I care a lot about this topic. So that is why I'm here today, I suppose.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. Mary, would you like to tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a bit similar to Abby, except I'm a heck of a lot older. And I'm also in healthcare, and I have a qualification in healthcare, and I have worked primarily with people with disabilities, and I have a disability myself.
Okay. And But most importantly, you are our first return guest.
Oh, stop. Yeah.
On the Vox Hibernia podcast. So it was great to listen to your forgiveness episode.
Okay.
And then here we are to talk about another complicated and heavy issue. Mm-hmm. So my name is Mike. I'm the host of Vox Hibernia. I'm the lead pastor of a church in Cork City. I have three kids, one of whom has a disability, all of whom are special and loved. I am married to Rachel, and I like coffee, books, and wearing black on hot days.
He's wearing all black.
I'm wearing all black and a grindcore t-shirt. All right, so we're in just a very complicated time in Ireland. It's not an easy time, I guess, to have opinions these days. Do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. It's kind of almost disconcerting how much of a disparity there is between me and, I would say, the majority of women my age. For me, it's like such a fine line to tread at the moment between being true to what I believe, which I am slowly learning how to do, whilst also, you know, trying to offend people to an absolute minimum. And obviously, I'm speaking here as a person whose beliefs could be described as pro-life. And yeah, that is a belief I take very seriously. And I recognize that that means that a lot of people consider that an offense to their own bodily autonomy. And I just want to say I recognize that. And I recognize that, yeah, I don't know what it's like to have an unplanned pregnancy or be in any of the hard cases. But yeah, I just want to say that I don't want to sound naive to any of that. But yeah, I want to speak with all of that in mind, all of those painful stories in mind, and I don't want to say anything that's judgmental. So that is my slight disclaimer. Yes, it is very hard to hold that belief today.
Sure. And Mary, do you find the same thing?
Yeah, but I kind of believe that I'm pro-life across the whole of life, so I'm also against the death penalty as well. So
too, yeah.
Yeah, and I know the argument sometimes is people who hold my opinion is that we're pro-birth and not pro-life.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that either, you know, because I think if you're going to be pro-life, it does mean that you take account of people in really difficult situations and you accept that it's really difficult, really painful, and that people need help, which might be loan parents' allowance, it might be subsidised housing, it might be help to, you know, put a baby up for adoption, it might be, you know, so it's a whole continuum of caring for people, mm-hmm. not just babies and newborns, but it's also the elderly, people with dementia, you know, people who are, you know, I suppose challenging, because I think in our society there are very vulnerable people, and I think the measure of a society is how we take care of them or how we support them.
So true.
Yeah, fascinating. I don't want to derail this whole thing, but on the topic of consistent pro-life ethic, I aim to have one. Mm-hmm. And that's caused me to even recently be rethinking my view on the death penalty. Mm-hmm. So I'm someone that used to believe that the death penalty is warranted in some circumstances. Mm-hmm. But the deeper and deeper that I'm looking into, I guess, these ethical issues, it's causing me to rethink that. So maybe that's another podcast down the line. But we definitely agree on this. Mm-hmm. And I am leaning towards what you would call a consistent pro-life ethic.
And an aside, you remember when the story about Jesus and the woman caught in adultery? If you look at the consequences, it was actually the death penalty he let her off with. Because in the law, that's what she was, and he didn't go that way.
Yeah,
as the great judge.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's partly where mine comes from. He could have enforced it, but he didn't. So
yeah,
that's my example of why I'm.
Well, you're edging me closer and closer.
Come on, Mike.
Okay, so as we're talking, I guess, about not just the issue of the Eighth Amendment, which maybe Abigail would be the best person to describe what the Eighth Amendment is.
So yeah, the Eighth Amendment is found in Article 40.3.3 of the Constitution, and it reads, "The state acknowledges the right to life of the unborn and, with due regard to the equal right of the mother, guarantees in its laws to respect and, as far as practicable, by its laws to defend and vindicate that right." So I think it's been there since a referendum in 1983. And yeah, it just places the right to life of the unborn at a constitutional level, which is described by one of my law friends as the heart of law in Ireland. And yeah, I suppose what we will be voting on the 25th of May is whether or not to completely remove that right to life from the Constitution and replace it with abortion being permissible by law. It's just that one simple sentence that it would be replaced by. And yeah, that is what we are going to be voting on. And yeah, I suppose the recent Supreme Court ruling, was it just a month or so ago, said that the only right that the unborn have is found within that. So that will be completely removed. And well, there is that kind of minimal protection afforded by quote unquote the common good as per the Supreme Court judges. But as to what that legislation will look like in future years, we can't predict that. And I would be cautious of the proposed legislation, because I know that we have that now, but none of us know what abortion legislation may look like in 5 years' time, 10 years' time. And that will be out of our control as a population. We won't be able to vote on this again if this passes. So that is something I would like to point out.
Okay, and so should the Eighth Amendment be repealed, does that mean the 2013 Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act would also be null and void?
That will be in place in the interim until they put new legislation in place. And yeah, I suppose there'll be further debates in the Dáil about what exactly that will be. And it probably will end up being that proposed legislation, although they haven't exactly guaranteed that, because Leo being Leo Varadkar has made clear that we're not voting on that, we're voting on just repealing the 8th. We can put a link to that quote in the show notes if you want. But and I'll probably ask Mike to put a link to a lot of things in the show notes. I'm like, reference everything. But yeah, what was the question again?
Well, yeah, on that, ironically, this is our 8th podcast.
Oh, cool.
And this will be the first time we've ever actually used the show notes. And I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of footnotes.
Yeah, be emailing them on.
So in that, I guess, discussion about the 8th Amendment, should it stay or should it go? Should it be repealed or should it be retained? What do you think is missing from the current conversation?
So, yeah, I think there's a great space for advocacy for the unborn. I would say the unborn child. Most people would use the word fetus. I prefer to say child. Yeah, I think there's very little, to use the words of Catherine McGuinness, former Supreme Court judge, reasonable and charitable debate on this subject. And I think that's evidenced by things like the repeal shield and just a complete kind of divide between the two sides and very little respectful conversation. And that upsets me so much, to be honest, because I think, like, it's not even being debated. It's just become like a catfight, to be honest. And like, I think people are nearly either too afraid to discuss it, or when it is discussed, it just becomes so divisive and upsetting. And it is a very, very, very upsetting topic. So I think that reasonable, charitable debate is definitely missing at the moment. I don't know if it's going to change. I'd love if it changed.
Yeah. And you mentioned the repeal shield. What's that?
So I think you're probably a better place to describe it, Mike, given that.
Yeah, well, let me explain. So the repeal shield, it's an account on Twitter, and it collates a list of the pro-life voices that are on, like, Irish Twitter. So with the click of a button, anyone's able to subscribe to this block list, and then 8,000 pro-life voices are muted so that people that don't want to hear from the offensive or from the trolls or to see graphic images, they can have that muted from Twitter. The thing is, like, not everybody that is on that list is a troll or uses disrespectful language or shows graphic images. I know, because I found myself on that list, that I was not able to see the tweets of people engaging in the pro-choice side of the arguments. They weren't able to see my tweets. And About once a month, I send out kind of a pro-life kind of tweet. It's not my big thing on Twitter. I like to read. I very rarely even comment, but I do like to see the issues. But I just found myself excluded from that conversation. In fairness, I wrote an email. Aiden got back to me. He said, "Hold on, we'll review your account." And then I waited, and then he got back, and then was it like late last night or early this morning? I got a message saying, like, you know, it was a mistake. You shouldn't have been there. But a lot of people that have been muted or blocked, like, you know, we're not fake accounts. We're not Russian trolls. We're real people that hold a pro-life view. And I really aim to be respectful in real life and especially online.
Yeah. Respectful and respected as well, I think, because I think each of us have our own experience and like are bringing this to the table and have read a lot about this and our life experience backs this view up. And I think, yeah, I think there's no reason that our voices shouldn't be heard, provided that we're speaking in love. And I know I probably don't have as much life experience as you guys, but yeah, I think respectful and respected, I think on both sides, these views should be.
Yeah, fantastic. Mary, would you agree about that? Or do you think that there's other things that are missing from the conversation?
I just think that it's all about the individual woman and her choice and her bodily autonomy. And that's the whole focus of it. But it has a bigger implication because, you know, I think the pro-choice view finds it hard to engage in the ethics of where this will lead us, particularly if you have a disability. So I think it makes them uncomfortable. I think it's not necessarily what they're trying to achieve, in fairness to them, but it does mean there are 100 million girls missing in the world because boys are favoured in a lot of cultures. It does mean that, you know, there's a lot of ethical issues about having a genetic condition, having a disability, and the narrative that, you know, people with disabilities are a burden, they will ruin your family life, you know, you won't get the services you need, their life will be marked by suffering, so therefore it's better if they don't exist. And that whole debate is very tricky and difficult, you know, because, you know, there are examples in Britain of people with cleft lip and palate, you know, those babies being terminated. You know, the bar is so low on what, you know, any reasoning around why somebody doesn't go ahead with a pregnancy for a baby who has a disability, or, you know, the negativity around disability. And it's almost like becoming more and more difficult if you have a disability to be born because of genetic testing. Yeah. And then once you are born, we have all these amazing rights.
Yeah, children's rights, disability rights.
Yeah, children's rights, disability rights, the UN. But getting to being born, I think, is getting harder. And I just wonder what it says about how we value people with disabilities, because I find, you know, what I don't have a serious condition, but it is genetic. So I'm there going, oh, how about if I'm screened out, or people like me are screened out, you know, very early in life? Yes, I would like not to have it. Yes, life would have been easier, but I'd still rather be here, you know. I'd still rather be part of the conversation. And I think as well, it's very difficult because where are we going with this in terms of, if you look at eugenics, it says only the best people should contribute to our society, should be part of our society. And this feels a bit like that to me, even though I understand that a lot of pro-choice people, including friends of mine, are very pro-disability rights for people. Mm-hmm. But it's after you manage to get born.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, the issue, because I think it's the whole piece of, if you're a burden, should you be here? So then we have the abortion debate. My instinct tells me we're going then towards euthanasia. That will be the next debate, and it will be about very difficult and painful cases. Yet at the same time, we do have really good palliative care here, because we don't have euthanasia.
Yeah.
We have good maternity care here. But I don't deny that some women have had very, very difficult times. There are huge issues around rape. There are huge issues around babies who aren't compatible with life, and whether women want to continue with those pregnancies. There are issues around women who are ill during their pregnancies. I'm not denying any of those. I do think that the 2013 Act covers all of that, and in a way we don't need to repeal the 8th, because those protections are already there. That would be, I'm not a legal person, but that's what it looks like to me. So we have the protections for the difficult cases, but I would imagine that the 2013 Act will be repealed. And again, I find it a bit disconcerting that they won't say what is coming. Just trust us.
Yeah.
Where your Oireachtas, just trust us, is what we're expected to.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky to trust politicians, I find, on the best of days, and even on trivial matters. And we are being asked once to trust them, I guess, from this point onward with this issue.
I think the politicians I've known, a lot of them are really hardworking. They're really sincere. And I think they're very, you know, because you have to re-go for election, they're very taken by public opinion. And one man that I know well, who's a politician, described being trapped in a restaurant recently because somebody was giving out about the changes they made to Patrick Street about the
road closures.
Yeah, yeah, and he was recognised in a restaurant and trapped for an hour by someone berating him. You know, so I have some sympathy for them, but I do think as well, I would rather know. Number one, I think that the hard cases are covered by the 2013 Act, the 2013 legislation, and I think taking that away with no guarantee about, you know, what they're proposing, it's a lot of trust me in it rather than, okay, tell us what you want. I think the vagueness is part of a strategy of getting it over the line.
Interesting.
Yeah. Just on the 2013 Act, I have a quote here from Mary Houlihan, a consultant obstetrician, and she said, Ireland's law fully provides for the small number of cases relating to necessary obstetric interventions. Where it arises, the duty to intervene to save the woman's life is clear. Under the present law, we have full freedom and support for the requirements of ethical and safe practice. And yeah, that was backed up by another obstetrician. And there are doctors that think this is clear, and then there are also doctors that think this isn't clear. And I'd be open to the idea of the 2013 Act being looked at because there are, you know, the grey areas in this issue are really, really grey. But I don't think that means that we have to bring in abortion to fix that. And I think we hold the belief of sanctity of life from the moment of conception, which is actually a crazy thought in these times. But biologically, it actually makes a lot of sense when you look into it. And I think we all know of a wonderful biology teacher, and she makes a great case for the conception being the moment at which human life begins. And yeah, although that might seem crazy and radical, that is what we believe.
And not just us.
Not just us.
It's not the three, like, of us and our biology teacher friends.
No, it's very true. It is a very, like, defensible belief, and we can link more things in the show notes for that.
Yeah, I'd love to perhaps have a more qualified biology voice to voice that opinion, but that is not a philosophical view nor a theological view alone. That's a scientific reality, that there is a new distinct human individual that comes together at the merging of the chromosomes. It's not a walrus. It's not a skateboard. It's a person. It's a human person that's created at that point, at a vulnerable and developing state. But in essence, we're all developing. We're all at various stages of development. And that earliest stage, it begins as a human person, we believe.
I think, too, it's difficult for people because I have friends who are vegetarian / vegan and really into animal rights and rescue creatures and all the time. And
oh, yeah, I'm a vegetarian.
Oh, yeah. So they are really into that, and they'd be quite pro-repeal. And then I think where the issue for them is, it's all about the autonomy of the woman's body. So that's where they have, you know, yeah. And yet they would go to huge lengths to rescue animals, which is great, and they're very kind to animals. But I think, you know, it's a body in a body.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so different. Like, you can have a different blood group, you can have so many other things that are going on there, that it is a person within a person rather than something in my body that I can choose to keep or not, you know. But I do think as well that it's the whole idea of looking at, it's not just about whether people like us are religious people or believe in God. It's also a whole ethical issue of, this is the most vulnerable you will ever be as a human being. And, you know, this is where you're totally dependent on another human being to care for you. And even if you look at human beings, the newborn baby is probably one of the most dependent creatures in all of the whole of the world. You know, they're born, like, you know, we've had a new baby in my family. They're born, they can't hold up their head, they can't do anything for themselves. It's total care. Mm. That seems to be the way we're created. And then by the time that baby's a year old, they can walk, they can put some food in their mouth, they can take a drink, they can say, they can babble, they might have a word or two. Like, our progression is phenomenal, but it starts off in the womb and onwards, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't doubt that it changes a woman's life. I got a book really recently by Gloria Steinem, you know, the feminist, and she had a blurb at the front of it. And she wrote a thank you to the man who gave her a backstreet abortion in her early 20s, which she said allowed her to live this life. I actually found it really sad because I was there thinking, I suppose it's easy for me to say that I had children in my early 20s. I didn't feel they ruined my life. I suppose I had kids will travel. I did, you know, I didn't do what Gloria Steinem did, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like if children stop you doing what you want, and it's about doing what you want. And she's an excellent writer and very evocative writer, very powerful writer. But to me, that was so sad. It's like a baby or a life. But you can have a baby and a life, I think.
Yeah. And I think may we never hold these views without making it easier for maybe the hard cases for women, single mothers, unplanned pregnancies, to have the best life they can have as a mother. And that is something I aim to have and want to have with my peer group and my sphere of influence. And I think a lovely example of that is someone, kind of a distant friend, had a baby recently, and she's quite a young mother. And one of my friends suggested that we all raise money to put together a hamper for her. And we raised close to €200 to, as a peer group, to make a hamper for this new baby and mom. And yeah, I think things like that, I'm like, if society, not to make my friend group sound so great, but I think those are, I think if that was more widespread and if there was less of, oh no, like this young girl is pregnant, this young woman is pregnant and like it's a disaster and her career is ruined. Less of that and a bit more like if just someone said to these girls, actually you can do it, you know, and you can be a mother. Mm. And yeah, I'm obviously working very hard at my career and my master's and everything, and I hope to have a good career as a young woman, but I also can't wait to be a mom. And yeah, I do think that that will be the best thing I do in my life. And I wouldn't want to push that belief on other people, but I would love if there was a bit more of a positive narrative around having kids and having being pregnant in Ireland. I think that's kind of strangely absent. Mm. And I think that will become even more taboo with abortion, arguably. Mm. But
I think there's a whole background to this, though, because I think Irish society has changed so much in 30 odd years for me, because it's almost like we have had one set of beliefs, and more or less, not completely, but and then we've jettisoned all of them. And I think some of this is a reaction against, you know, the perception that, say, the Catholic Church had hegemonic control in Ireland and it controlled everything. And because of that, it's like kick everything out. But then a lot of the things that we value in our culture, like the rule of law, like the dignity of the human being, like, you know, what our law is based on, is based on those values, which, you know, it doesn't mean that they were perfectly applied. They weren't. I mean, you know, talking about supporting young women, you know, I remember going to help a friend of mine to have a pregnancy test when I was 18, and she was absolutely distraught when she was pregnant and walking down South Mall. She tried to throw herself in front of a bus, and I was holding on to her going, you know, and we went and we actually met a lovely social worker who was very severe looking, and she had pearls on and very severe hair, and I thought, oh my goodness, she's going to give out to us. And she was so kind, and she calmed her down, and she, you know, but what looked like an absolute disaster didn't wreck that woman's life. It wasn't easy, because back then to have a baby outside marriage was just such a huge deal, and it was like, get married, put your baby up for adoption. They were your choices. It felt like they were your choices, because you're shaming the family. And I think a lot of what's going on now is almost, for me, a kickback against that culture and against that society. And a lot of women suffered a lot. We had Magdalene Laundries with Tuam Baby Home. We had the rate that babies outside marriage died at. It was frightening. You know, they weren't looked after. They weren't cared for. They were buried in unmarked graves. We have a dreadful legacy. But none of that was Jesus. None of that was God. None of that reflected his values about how he saw people in trouble. That was a moralistic, shame-filled culture we were part of, rather than anything that reflected Christianity. But the other side of that is true as well, because I was part of a project that supported women in that position. I worked there for 5 years. Generally, the women who came to us were young. Their families had rejected them. Their boyfriends were gone. They were living a long way from home to hide the pregnancy. And then what happened, I'm in contact with lots of them still. two of them are lecturers in college now. One of them is a really successful businesswoman. Another is, and if you saw where they started, you think, so even me, I had my kids really young and then I went to college. You know, it's not that your life is over. You know, your life takes a different trajectory and it doesn't mean that it's over. You have to, you know, but I know that's hard to say at the time because the narrative is that if you have a baby, it'll ruin your life. I do think we have to be practically supportive of women. Mm. You know, I think it's great to give a hamper. I think that's great. I think it's also great to babysit the baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
It's great. It's a great start. I think it's great to have, you know, if there's no dad, some men in there in the mix who will be like dads to, you know, I think of a lovely story of, it's a dreadful story, but how it turned out. This young woman that I knew started going out with a guy. They were engaged to be married. She got pregnant. And when she was 8 months pregnant, he came to her and said, this is a guy in his 30s, which is hard to believe, said, wasn't ready for parenting, didn't want to be a parent, didn't want to be married, didn't want the responsibility and abandoned her. And I remember she was okay. Her family were so angry. Like her sisters, one of my children, was so angry, so upset. And then they supported her. Her sister went with her to in the delivery room. Her father, the girl's grandfather, stepped in and was wonderful. And then that young single mother later on married a lovely guy and he's been a really good husband to her, and his whole family, she's regarded as the oldest grandchild, even though they had other children afterwards. So it doesn't even, you know, she had things going for her. She had a loving family. She had a supportive family. I accept that. But sometimes I think people make a decision on at the moment, they catastrophize, my life is over, rather than, okay, how can I help someone? There are options here. Yeah. There is help out there. It's tapping into that rather than the narrative that this is it.
Right. Why don't you talk about when you were involved in that work with the, I remember you were just saying how that first word that you'd say to
her. Oh, yeah.
That's just, I think that's amazing.
Yeah. Back then, if you had a baby, you know, if you were pregnant, these women, when they were pregnant, it was like, oh my goodness, this is awful. How could, dare you be pregnant? But the lady who set the project up was so kind. And anytime anybody came to the project, you know, who was pregnant, the very first thing she always said was, congratulations on the pregnancy. Yeah. And they always fell apart crying. She was the first person to congratulate them on the pregnancy. Because the pregnancy was a mistake and how could you do this, and it was all drama, and they just fell apart. And she said, you know, we're going to help you, we're going to support you, you're going to be a great mom, if you need anything we're here. And it was just the power of that, to know I'm not on my own. You know, I'm, you know, some of them were in bedsits in a city far away from home, you know, knowing no one. And even to have a community that, you know, going to each other's houses, is actually in this building, you know, coming here to drop into this building, a whole network around you of, you know, friendships and all of that, you know. It wasn't, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, it wasn't always easy, but a lot of times people need a community, and it was making that community for these young women was really important. And I can honestly say for the women from that group that I'm still in contact with, none of them, it didn't destroy their life having that baby. It certainly changed the route that they were on.
Yeah.
But their life was enhanced afterwards, you know. Once they got over the trauma of, often the most traumatic thing was how people reacted to the pregnancy.
Yeah.
You know, this extreme, oh my goodness, you've disgraced the family, or you've ruined your life, or your career is over, or you'll never get to climb the Himalayas now because, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's always the baby is the problem rather than, you know, how can we... And babies aren't born in isolation. You know, we need a community to bring up babies.
That's so true. It's like, it's a cliche, but it is true that it does take a village to raise a child.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
And it's interesting to marry that with, like... You know, there's a whole kind of, it's deemed to be so empowering, this choice. But I think so often it's not even really a choice. It's seen as this like really miserable last resort where there's an absence of choice and an absence of support. Mm. And I wonder how many people would really choose it or even imagine it if there was a different narrative and a different, like just a community element to this and a supportive element to this. And I think... If we imagine a utopian Ireland, which, I mean, I always get criticized for being an idealist, and I'm only partly apologetic for that, because I think a bit of idealism doesn't go astray here. like, in a utopian Ireland, would abortion be necessary and would it exist? And I don't think it would. And I think there's a whole load of things that feed into that to make it that utopian Ireland, quote unquote. And I don't want to sound naive and say that we can instantly have a utopian Ireland. I think there's definitely, we need to work on that. And there's so many things that feed into that, like making it easier for someone to be a working mom. And, you know, I know we had the recent Belfast rape trial and we're all appalled by that because, like, you know, it's pretty much impossible to convict someone of rape. And I think that feeds into this as well. Yeah, I think there's, it will be hard to make Ireland a country in which abortion isn't deemed necessary by people. But I'd love if that's what we were working towards. And I think that women deserve better than abortion. And I don't want society to be one where abortion is necessary. And I think when you look at it fundamentally and the ethics of it and the biology of it, it's really, really hard to escape the fact that it is, and I don't mean to say this in a judgmental way, the ending of a life, and it's a human life. And yeah, there is this kind of interesting ethical argument that says basically that abortion and infanticide are so, you know, they're minimally different, therefore infanticide is okay. And that was published in an ethical journal in the last few years. But like, well, our perspective is abortion and infanticide are minimally different, therefore abortion is not okay. And yeah, it's just that big difference.
I think it kind of feeds back though into eugenics. If you look at, say, that, I know the article you're talking about, because yeah, I've seen it too.
Shocking article.
Yeah. But I think what it is, you know, when a baby is born and they have multiple disabilities, it's like, oh, how could this baby live? Their quality of life is going to be so poor. I find as well, though, because I've worked in disability for a long time, there are people who are so medically fragile, they're rarely seen in public, or, you know, it's very difficult to you know, initially when people meet them, they find them quite shocking, and yeah, they see the disability as like this huge wall. And then after a while they get to know them and they're just like, oh, that's Peter, and he likes Chinese food and he likes to drink coffee, and he, rather than this is Peter who, you know is his disability. Because sometimes, you know, where I work, we have two descriptors of people, and the staff I work with always laugh at me. I said, please do not put down the diagnosis as the descriptor of this human being. You know, it's not I have Down syndrome and moderate learning disability. It's like, I'm Peter and I like Arsenal. Obviously he has good taste. I support Cork FC. I like to go to Starbucks. And, you know, the descriptor you would do of anybody else before you got to their diagnosis. But I think it's almost like we've made people with disability other than us, you know, rather than their people who happen to have a disability, and how do we support them to have a meaningful life. But I suppose I just worry about where we're going with this, because I really get how difficult cases are. I think that I don't know that we could ever eliminate abortion, to be honest, even, you know, because I do think that people have such a fear that their life is over and all of that kind of thing. And there will always be difficult cases, and there will be cases where, you know, where, like you spoke earlier, obstetricians have to make very difficult calls, but they're very rare. Mm. And this is about, I suppose my fear about this is that it's a type of contraception, really, is what it's going to be, you know, rather than, you know, that it's minimized, that it's that, when it's so much bigger than that, you know. And, you know, so I do think it has consequences. And I think as well, even the reaction in the public square to women who came to Ireland and who had survived abortion, you know, it was largely women, you know, who had abortion had been attempted on them when they were in the womb and they survived. Mm. And there was, even to find a public space that they could speak, I thought that was really crazy. It felt very, to me, it felt very controlling about, you know, that our media can't even let these people speak, that it's so uncomfortable to let them actually say, this is who I am, this is what happened to me, I did survive, you know, all of those stories. It's like we want to make it really easy. It's black and white. It's about a choice.
Yeah.
It's not about where are we going around gender. Will there be more boys than girls because of this? Where are we going around disability? And will we allow people with disability to be born? Where are we going then about infanticide, about very, very fragile children who were born. Yeah. Where are we going about euthanasia? And I know people say, oh, no, you're crazy. This is, won't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is it does happen, because this, once you start saying that a human being isn't fully human and we will judge whether you can live or not, what about the dementia patient then?
Mm.
What about advanced, you know, where are we going with all of this? And we're going to have a lot of very powerful decision makers who will decide these things about people's lives. And that's a kind of a scary thing too, I think.
Yeah, so true. I think it's worth noting, as we're talking about disability, the grounds on which abortion will be granted under the proposed legislation, and that is abortion for any reason up until 12 weeks, and then between 12 weeks and viability, there is, if there is a risk to the health or life of the mother, we can get the exact wording of that. Hold on, I'll get the exact wording.
But 12 weeks, I you know, the really difficult cases where babies aren't viable after the outside of the womb, I think that that will come in somehow, you know, because I think that's, I think,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
that's where it's going, you know. I do.
Yeah. So the proposed legislation, it's on request up until 12 weeks with a 3-day waiting period. Then up until viability of the fetus, where two doctors certify that there is a risk to the life of the pregnant woman. And the same thing if there's a risk to serious harm of the health of the pregnant woman. And then there is abortion without gestational limitation for fatal fetal anomaly, where two doctors agree on that. And that is, I think there has to be agreement between the obstetricians that the child wouldn't live for a couple of days past birth, or would die shortly, well, would die during the pregnancy possibly as well. And that is the proposed legislation, but as we kind of mentioned before, there's no way of knowing what that legislation will look like in the future and how it may be used in the future. And I think it's definitely not a crazy belief to hold that this may be used to justify down the line the abortion on the basis of other forms of disability, when you look at the patterns in other countries and 90% of children with Down syndrome being aborted. And that's a place that we don't want to go. And I think that's why it's justifiable to talk about disability in this context.
But there are other solutions as well, because, you know, because of wearing my disability hat, there are babies who are abandoned at birth because parents aren't happy to. But one of the big issues then is adoption, because you can't adopt them because you can't have consent from the parents. So that, you know, we did have that referendum to change things, remember, a few years ago.
Yeah.
But to my knowledge, I haven't yet come across cases where, say, the child of a valid marriage being adopted, mm-hmm. or, you know, so there are anomalies there, because there are people who are willing to adopt babies with Down syndrome, you know, but they need to make it that bit easier to adopt them, you know, particularly if they're the child of a valid marriage.
Yeah.
So it's, in theory, the law is there to do it, but I haven't yet come across it in practice where it's actually happened. We're all waiting for, I think, the Supreme Court to pronounce on a few of these.
Yeah, there's only been one instance of adoption of a child of a married parent, as far as I'm aware. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very hard to jump through those legal loopholes. And,
and I'm not suggesting a British type model, because some people really worry about the British model, where children come into care and within a year they're put up for adoption. And a lot of people like me have a lot of worries about that, because I think if you have somebody who's addicted or whatever, you're cutting people off. You know, you don't give them a lot of time to get their life together, you know, and that's where British society is going. A lot of kids are being adopted there. So it's too early to judge where the benefits are not at that. We'll have to wait till those kids grow up.
Yeah.
But I have a friend and her nephews and nieces were adopted and no contact then. So she's, as she said, you know, they cut you off from the broader family and didn't give the broader family an option, weren't consulted, you know.
Yeah.
So again, I think it's an imperfect system. I'm probably rambling. It's an imperfect system. But we do need to really think about supporting families.
Yeah, and be looked into. And I think it's worth noting as well, as a friend of ours notes as well, that, like, if we are advocating a pro-life position, I think we definitely have to really look at our lives and say, well, would I be willing to adopt myself, the imperfect system aside, and potentially foster myself? And that is something I would definitely be strongly tempted by, to use the word tempted, I suppose, depending on what my future partner thinks as well. But my current partner, hi Dan, please can we foster a child?
we've talked about this before. But so yeah, I definitely think that like if we are advocating this position, then we have to make the world easier, and I think that is part of it.
Yeah, because I have this phrase that I love: inside my circle of control and outside my circle of control. So inside my circle of control, what can I positively, actively do to support people who are in really difficult situations?
Yeah.
You know, I can't change the world, but I can do something inside here.
Yeah, yeah.
When I come across some, like your example with the hamper, or like offering support in the long run, like, you know, minding a child so their parents get a night out, mm-hmm. or you know, whatever it is, you know, but just being there practically, you know.
Yeah, so true.
Yeah.
I think you said something really wise earlier as well, Mary, about like how all of these tiny decisions amount to a society and a culture within society. And like, are we going to make tiny decisions about, well, seemingly tiny individual decisions to care and show love and support, or to say, well, actually, abortion is the best option for us? And I think that's such a hopeless position, to be honest. And I know that's colored by my own worldview, but I've read extensively about this, and I nearly wish that it wasn't so convincing, because in a way it would be so much easier to believe in the pro-choice. And, but to be in agreement with most women my age, it would be so much easier. But yeah, I can't hold that position. I have to believe there is better for women and for children in Ireland and for society.
I think too, there's a lot of evidence that in cultures where abortion is readily available, and then it becomes known that a woman is, you know, pregnant with a less than perfect child, there's so many stories about women feeling under pressure to terminate because the people they interact with can't believe they're going ahead with this pregnancy, you know, because, and again, it's that whole narrative, this child will ruin your life, it'll ruin your family's life, you know, this child will suffer terribly. And sometimes it's health professionals who have a broad medical training, of course, but have never worked in the disability sector, who've never seen that there's an enormous, I suppose, what would you say, that there's a continuum of people, say, with Down syndrome, from people, yes, who are severe to profound and nonverbal and require a huge amount of care, to a whole group of people who lead very meaningful, happy lives, you know, and contribute to our society in another way.
And enrich society.
Yeah, and enrich society, because, you know, so it doesn't take away from the fact that there are very challenging people with disability, but they are the minority. Because if you look at disability statistics, off the top of my head, 4%. But the people who are the most challenging are less than 1%, you know, and even there's a percentage below that again who require the levels of care. But I, many years ago, I was involved in caring for a young guy who was profound disabilities arising out of an accident, right? So he had been an ordinary little person, and then something traumatic happened. I won't say what, because it might identify him. And then he ended up needing total care. And he had, and to his family and the people who knew him, it was a terrible tragedy. But I never knew that boy. I only knew this guy that we cared for. And he loved certain food. He loved, his favorite drink was a pint of Murphy's, so he had to have a pint of Murphy's every day. He liked different.
And how old was this child?
Oh, he was an adult. Don't worry, we weren't giving alcohol to a child. But like, think about it. Somebody cared enough to find out what would he like to drink. Somebody cared enough to figure out what would he like to eat. So his favorite, Chinese food. So how did we know? He couldn't get out of bed and go and buy Chinese food. Mm-hmm. Somebody cared enough about him to say, how can we, you know, the whole theory of normalization, which came from the civil rights movement, which said we don't lock our people away. They lead, normalization is the late 60s. And I think it lines up nicely with Martin Luther King and the whole idea of your dignity, your worth as a human being. Okay, so you have those ideas that went, they were in civil rights, they were in feminism, they were also in the disability sector, they were in normalisation, they were in people like Jean Vanier, who started L'Arche, you know, the dignity and worth of people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So I worked with him, and eventually he died, and I was one of the people involved in laying him out. It's a really powerful thing to lay out somebody who's died that you physically cared for. And there was a group of us there talking about him, and I've never forgotten what one of them said. And she said, he made us a better person, because she said, like, you could be so cranky and fight with your husband and be in terrible bad form, and you'd arrive into work and you'd look at him and go, if I don't feed him, he won't be fed. If I don't bathe him, he won't be bathed. If I don't take care of him, who will? But what happened to him could happen to any of us.
Yeah.
So then when he died, there was there was about 100 people went to his funeral who had known him as this person, and one of the managers gave an amazing speech about him. His personality, he wasn't a disability, he was a human being with choices, with people who cared about him, with favourite staff, with people who worked with him. And you would say, what has that got to do with abortion? We are not our disability. We are a person first who happens to have a disability. And I my fear is around this is we'll be defined by, why didn't you terminate, rather than, you know?
Yeah.
Mm. That's my fear.
That's so powerful, just the, that's it, like, he made us a better person. And I think that's so beautiful. And I think that can be applied, I know it's very different circumstances, to parenthood in general. I know I'm the only non-parent in the room, but I know I've just, parenting looks great. I mean, can you, do you want to comment, guys, on your kids?
I think the narrative about parenting is pajama clad children by a glowing fire and you're reading them a story and it's all wonderful. That's a small piece.
There's also my romanticization,
lots of work. And there's days when you're, you know, I was talking to somebody lately and they were saying, I'm the worst parent in the world, and da da da. And I was saying, no, you're not the worst parent in the world. You know, and kids have their own unique personality. It's really rewarding and it's hard work. And you know, then when they grow up, you get grandchildren. They're really great. No, kids are great, but it's hard work too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think, parenting?
Yeah, parenting is hard work. And yeah, as I mentioned, yes, I have three kids. I have Finn, I have Rosie, and I have Owen. Owen is 12. He has autism, and he also has some additional developmental or mental handicaps. And yeah, I'd say he's in the 4%. He's not in that 1%, mm-hmm. or in the one of the 1 mm-hmm. Percent. He is my son. He's quite normal to me. But then I also realize that, you know, he has tics. He flaps his arms a lot, and there's things that he does that are quite unusual to other people. But he's that's just how he acts. That's just who he is. And I would say, like, as he's 12, as he's becoming a teenager, things are changing again, because now he's not a child. He's a young man,
and he's tall.
Yeah, he's taller than his mom. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And yeah, but I mean, just like 2 or 3 days ago, you know, we had the kind of the first milestone where, like, I kind of taught him to shave. So
wow.
Yeah. And you know what? That was like, that was hard, because
Mike,
that's,
do you know how to shave yourself? Mike, a very prominent beard. Sorry.
I used the beard trimmer on him, but that was something that I was, you know, I guess every that's this like rite of passage, and it just it just felt so different than I imagined that it would be, I guess, where there was kind of a sense of the sense of loss that's like, you know, he doesn't even kind of get it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, will he ever do this himself? Mm-hmm. And these types of things. Mm-hmm. And I bet that he will, but it's probably going to be a good couple of years off. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to undersell it and be like, oh, yeah, everything's fine. But on the one hand, I'm very used to it. But then even now at the stage of adolescence, like, things are changing once again. And it's like, okay, the other dads of 12-year-olds, this is a very special moment for them. And this is like a kind of a challenging moment for me.
Mm-hmm. I think lots of parents I've worked with, they talk about it. It's doing the things that are different, like the special preschool as opposed to the local preschool, the special school or unit compared to the local preschool, the local school. Those are painful things, you know, they are, because it's never kind of what we wanted. And it's almost like rewriting a new story. And I think that's difficult for people, because, you know, I've met with people and they can't imagine a life around, outside of the best school, the best university, the best career, the best. And it really makes you say, is that what defines you? Is it your achievement? Mm-hmm. And you have to really pare it all back and say, what makes a person human? What makes them valuable? Is it how much money they can make for our culture? Is it going back to Christianity's basic values, that you have an inherent worth within yourself because you're made in the image of God? And it's not just like a unit of production that you are, or a contributor or a maker of stuff, but your very existence matters. and that we're always going to have people like there's a writer and her name escapes me, but she writes comedy. But she talked about this whole kind of circle of life thing. She described how she remembered, you know, her mum taking care of her, and then one day she was driving the car and her mum was sitting in the front seat and she had to slam down the brakes, and she put her hand in front of her mother, and she said that was, you know, it just showed what was coming, that she had turned into her mother's carer. Then she had children herself, and she has since passed away, and she said she was driving one day and her son was driving her and he put his hand in front of her, and she just saw it as this moment. And we all do that. We have time, we live our lives as if our lives are perfect, and they're not, you know. So I suppose I'm a bit unusual because I've had lots of surgeries, and I've had times where my kids have taken care of me, my kids have helped me get dressed, my kids, so I'm younger than most people have that, but that's been temporary, you know, because I've been unwell for a period or a season. But every one of us will have times where we're vulnerable and we're less than, and we're saying the very act of vulnerable makes you less than. Then people go through enormous crisis if their whole worth is based on production rather than the sheer fact you live, it makes you valuable. If it's based on production, you have a bad car crash, you develop a new illness, you become unable to work. People go through enormous existential crisis around that. And why is that? They don't believe they have worth outside what they contribute.
Yeah.
So have I worth if I can no longer do my job?
Yeah.
Or if I have to retire early? Or if I'm in an accident? And it's all based on this whole thing on this, as if we have this complete autonomy, but it's about how we produce and how we contribute. And there's
a kind of a capitalism thing ultimately, isn't it?
I sound like a die in the hard Marxist, and I'm not, but
none of us are communists.
No, you sound like a Christian, because that is the Christian worldview. Then, and I love, and you know, as those of people of faith, the Christian faith who hold this pro-life position, you know, we can point to like Jeremiah 1, Psalm 139, et cetera, which points to like the value and the worth of the preborn infant. Mm. And that's wonderful. But like also we can say, isn't it great that God sees value in people before they've done anything?
Yeah.
Like how counterintuitive, because all the things that you're saying is like, what's our value? Our value is what we can produce. Mm. Our value is how we can contribute to the general well-being. Mm. But God says that we're valuable before we do anything. Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful. And you know this, but you know, I was in an accident last summer. I got hit by a car, and my brain got kind of rattled, and I could like barely read, I could barely speak for a while, and like thankfully like I've recovered, and I'm at like 90% of what I used to be, feels like. But I had this existential crisis that I'm sure you probably experienced on multiple levels, on multiple occasions. But for me, just once, I was like, I can't like read very well, and I can't speak very well, and I get all my words mixed up. Mm-hmm. And for me, like as a professional reader and speaker, I was like, well, that means what will I do? What's my worth? And so I had to kind of just like relearn all of this once again, not just how to read and speak again, but how to find value, not in what I produce, but who God has made me to be. And that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, because I found for me, it was, I spent a couple of years in hospital as a kid, and then I had a mid period of my life where I was fairly healthy, and then around 19 everything started to get really bad, and you know, walking got harder, and I got a really bad back, and I got married at 21, and I had warned my husband to be that my prognosis in the future wasn't great and I could probably get worse and da 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 da. So 2 weeks before the wedding I couldn't walk, and I mean I couldn't walk, I was like hunched over, and I was like, are you sure this is what you signed up for? And he has a great sense of humor, and he said, don't worry girl, we'll get a wheelbarrow, you'll be grand, I'll stick you in a wheelbarrow.
Bless him.
So it was fine, I was upright again by the wedding, but I did really mean it when I said it to him, this is what's coming, you know. So then I had kids really quickly, because I think I knew I didn't have time like other women had.
Yeah.
So, but say third pregnancy at 26, couldn't walk for most of it. I used to have to crawl up the stairs on my hands and knees just to, and I would have loved, poor Morris, he always said, thanks, but I'm gone. Because I would have had 6 or 8 kids. I just love kids, you know. I don't know that I'm the best parent in the world, but I love kids. So I would have carried on having kids, and my gynecologist said, you can have kids, but you're going to spend every pregnancy in bed. And I thought, I can't do that. I had 3 kids already under 4. But each phase of that was a sadness and coming to terms with who I am. and coming to terms with needing painkillers and coming to terms with not ever having, I would never win Housewife of the Year. I was barely functioning. It was like, has everyone clean clothes? Has everyone food? You know, are we functioning? But, you know, it did mean that I had to relearn that a whole time. I won't be baking.
Yeah.
I won't be doing X, Y, and Z. I can't Hoover anymore. There's all these things I can't do. Do I still have worth? Yes. Do I do things to compensate for that? Yes. Do we have a marriage where I work and my husband is retired early and he cooks my dinner? Yes. Do I care? Not really. You know, so it's just that whole thing of what is that? I love the idea of hegemony because it says, what does the culture think? And am I part of that? So then it makes you go back. So do I have worth on a day I'm not walking well? Do I have worth on a day I'm in pain? Do I have worth on a day where I don't? Yes, I do. But I think that it's a real privilege to have a Christian ethic and worldview about being made in the image of God. Do I like all of this? Heck no. I'd like to ask, you know, I know some people are really spiritual and they accept everything and they say, I have had times where I have found it really difficult. Really difficult, particularly pain. I have no fancy expressions about pain because pain can completely upend your thing. But I love the idea that we will see our creator someday. Job will know why what happens. No, he knows what happens. I will know someday why this has meaning. And I think one of the things about growing up in a very devout home was I never denied the fact that suffering was part of life. I always knew that. I was always taught that. There will be suffering. You know, we live in the veil of tears, which sounds very... but there will be suffering as well as joy. So that was probably a good way to go through life. So then when it happened, it wasn't a shock to me, even though I didn't like it.
I just want to say one thing on that. I just love that what's coming true is like it's our worth is not in what we produce, and that we're neither saying that a woman's worth is in producing children, which I'm always afraid of when I have these conversations, because it's that stereotype of like only valuing women and their reproductive system and all this. Like you can like, and you, neither is your worth in your career. And I think we're like the young women of today are kind of like being asked to do both in a really pressurized way. And there's all these weird things now, like companies like offering women to freeze their eggs and like, do you know? And it's like, I don't know. I do question that, to be honest, because it's like there's such a conflict of interest there of like your employer kind of buying away your young years and like putting that into like a capitalist system. And I know, like, you know, having a career is amazing, but like I do question some of the implications of that. But anyway, you were going to say
there's a lovely
more.
Equation about having children young or older. So that I think is true. It says, if you have your kids young, lots of energy, no money. And if you wait to have them, more money, less energy. And that's the equation. Yeah. And then the other thing is, women don't have time. We just don't. Like, once you hit 35, your fertility just really collapses a lot. And my mum was a midwife, and she had this is not scientific, this was her opinion. She had delivered lots and lots of babies, and she said the best age was 18 to 26. No bother. Women had no trouble having kids. But she said after 35, 36, people had found it harder again in her experience. So she was determined to have her children by the time she was 35. She got married at 32, so it was like 1, 2, 3, and she finished at 35, and that was it. Because she had such a... I'm not suggesting that. That was just her opinion, and I was brought up on it. But it's just the whole idea that we sometimes you do have your kids early, you can still have a career if that's what you want. Yeah. And but there's value in whatever we do. It's not about production. There's value. I was at home with my kids for a good few years. I worked part-time a little bit. You know, I grew up with a working mother. My mother-in-law was a working mother. I'm not against working women. So I just think we have to be guided by it in our own family, by our own relationship with God, by what we and our husband or wife or whatever want to do. You know, there isn't like one formula that fits everybody, which is the great thing about being following our creator, because he made us a bit different.
Yeah. So speaking of, I guess, that Christian ethic of value, what are the alternatives? You talked about how you used to teach a class on this topic.
I used to design staff induction for people working with disability. Okay. So again, I was trying to get people... just to do a whole thing about how are people in disability seen in Ireland. So in ancient Ireland, under Celtic law, people with disabilities were particularly protected. So if you cheated somebody, for instance, who had a disability, you were more severely punished than if you cheated a person who didn't. So people with disabilities had the right to marry, they had the right to own property, they had the right to have children, and the consequences of harming them in any way were more severe. Then people say, oh, Christianity must have been dreadful. But it actually wasn't around people with disability, because it had this idea of what they call in Irish, Dinala Dia, person with God, which means that if God sent you a child with a disability, he had chosen you to raise a saint, because that person was automatically going to heaven. And you see that sometimes among older people who say, you know, if you have a baby Down syndrome, oh, God has blessed you. And some younger people get really upset by that because they didn't choose to have a baby with a disability, but it comes from this ancient idea of a Dinala Dia. Then the biggest change that happened to that was eugenics in the middle of the 19th century, because, you know, Darwin himself, I don't believe, was into eugenics. It was his cousin Francis Galton, and it was this whole idea that get rid of the less able, you know. You know, it's that whole idea of you breed good cattle and you grow good plants. Well, shouldn't we transfer those ideas onto human beings? So then that's where we had forced sterilization in America. It was very common. It never came to Ireland because of our very strong Catholic strong Christian ethic around procreation. But we never had that here. But it was in a lot of Nordic countries. It was in America where you forcefully sterilized people, often against their wishes, often without their knowledge. You know, minority populations, indigenous people around the world. But a lot of this idea, like if you look at Mein Kampf, Hitler's work, he built on the ideas of eugenics. And he has this very chilling phrase, basically, that people with disabilities should be piteously, without pity, exterminated. So to get people in Germany used to that idea, they made really awful films, which you can see online if you want to, in black and white, making people with disabilities look scary, shaved heads in sort of like sackcloth, rocking. And the whole narrative was around, you know, the money we're wasting on these less than humans and their life is terrible, and we could be using that for educating other people. So initially what they did was they tried out the gases that they used in concentration camps on this population. It's reckoned 150,000 people with disabilities were exterminated in centres where their families had placed them for care. And sometimes they lied and said that they had died of pneumonia or a heart attack or whatever, but roughly 150,000. And the whole narrative was, they're less than human, they cost us money, they shouldn't be here, it's a mercy to get rid of them, you know. And so then on we go then. So then you had all these segregated institutions where kids as young as 3 and 4 were taken away, put in big institutions. And sometimes people who did that thought they were helping them. But some of it was around the shame of having someone with a disability. Then we move on, civil rights, normalization, you know. And I wonder with all of this, I think we're going back against all the progress we've made. Once you're born, great. But getting to be born now with your disability, the bar is going to be set a lot higher. And it's all of that negative stuff again about what the person's quality of life, if they have a disability, the impact on the family and the impact on the society.
Well,
we talked for ages.
We've talked for ages. And we probably could talk for another age or two, part two and part three of this episode, perhaps. But yeah, Abby, is there anything that you feel that you were waiting to be asked but weren't? Well, hey, so Abigail. Abigail, you were describing your, about what, 2 weeks ago, you decided to on social media kind of come out as someone who holds a pro-life position.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah, to multiple things. I suppose I took it very seriously because I knew that that people were going to see me differently afterwards, and I think people do see me slightly differently afterwards, but I made sure to kind of phrase it in the most respectful way I possibly could, in the most palatable way I possibly could, without you know, diluting what I believe and being true to myself. And I suppose it's been quite freeing, because now I just feel like I can be me and I don't have to kind of just stay silent when people are giving out about pro-life stuff. And I just want to maybe prove that you can be reasonable and pro-life, although my reasonableness is open to debate and question. But yeah, I don't know if I'm proving that, but that is my goal.
And have you been able to have respectful conversations with people now, or is it, do you feel a wall between you and others, or how has that
it's
been?
It's a good question. Yeah, like someone a couple of people have approached me about it and said, yeah, I like the way you phrased that, but I really don't agree with you. And I think it's all about being sensitive to when people are open to debate and discussion and questioning. And I think it's something I would never want to force on people, because, you know, it's kind of like that shouting in an echo chamber. You know, I would never want to force anything on people, although people would argue that voting no is a forcing thing. But yeah, yeah, I think it is good, and I think it will open conversation, and yeah, I'm able to be more true to myself now. And when people aren't open to conversing, and when I feel like it's going to end in just misery and ruin a friendship, then that's where I'm like, right, I still want to be friends with you, and I'm willing to put this aside. Let's still be friends. So I hope we can all still be friends after this.
Yeah, I think it's very polarizing, because I think there's big narratives about both sides. So if you're pro-choice, it means you're like a baby killer and you have these extreme values and you don't care about children. And that's not true.
Yeah,
it is simply isn't true. And if you're pro-life, you're not trying to force people to have babies they don't want to have. That's not what you're looking at. You're looking at the overall, where are we going with this? What does it mean? How can we support people? But I think it's a bit like you were describing earlier, being cut off in Twitter from a whole group. I want to be able to have respectful conversations with people. I have very close friends and people I'm really close to who have the opposite opinion to me. And it's almost, like you said, a test of the relationship to be able to talk about it. But I don't doubt their sincerity, and I don't doubt why they hold their views, where they're coming from. I understand all of that. Personally, I still think a lot of it is a big reaction to what happened in Ireland in the past, and trying to right a wrong almost. But we can't right what happened in the past, but we certainly can learn from it, because I think we had a form of Christianity that was moralistic and was full of shame and was about hiding and about, you know, judging people. And that was never the essence of the gospel. I mean, the people that Jesus judged were the Pharisees and the hypocrites and people who said one thing and did something else, which is kind of what we were doing in that culture, rather than saying, how do we support people? How do we love people? You know, the whole idea that if you were born outside marriage, you were a bastard, you were illegitimate. That's not a long time ago. And somehow we're overcorrecting, I think. I just do. I think we're overcorrecting, and we don't know where our moorings are changing. And this is part of it. But I think we need to kind of accept as well that a lot of what underpins the Christian worldview is based on really believing that people matter, all people.
Yeah. And there's a poster that we walked past on the way in that says, stop shaming women. And can we all agree? Let's stop shaming people. Let's stop shaming women.
Yeah.
Shame has no place in discourse. It's been spent already.
Yeah. And like all the pain that, like all those painful stories on the In Her Shoes Facebook page and the horrible stories, like we're not immune to that. We're not affected by that. We're not upset. We're not upset by those horrible stories. Like I get so upset by them, and I do want better for those women and those girls. We really do, but we just want better in a different way.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for listening. And if you want to get in touch, you can contact us on Twitter. If we're not on the repeal shield, you can find us on Twitter, Vox Hibernia Pod, Instagram and Facebook, Vox Hibernia. And thank you so much for listening. We'd love feedback, and do check out the show notes, especially because that'll be full of links and footnotes and citations for some of the things that we've talked about. Thank you very much. Bye.